This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Peggy Orenstein, says she went to extremes to have a baby during her 6 years of infertility treatments. That's the subject of her memoir, Waiting for Daisy. Daisy is the name of her daughter. Last Sunday, Orenstein wrote the New York Times Magazine cover story about an increasingly popular infertility treatment, the use of donor eggs to get pregnant. Donor eggs are enabling more older women in their 40s and early 50s to get pregnant. Orenstein's article is titled Your Gamete, Myself. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Peggy Orenstein, welcome back to Fresh Air. Before we get to just like the larger process of egg donation, when you were trying to get pregnant, you tried absolutely everything. Why did you include egg donation as one of the things you tried?
Well, you know, I have to say, if you had asked me 10 years ago, if I would even have taken, you know, the most basic fertility drug, I would have said no. I was somebody who didn't particularly want to have kids. And then, you know, there's a big difference between being told, thinking that you don't want to have children and being told that maybe you can't. And I think that that's where desire and obsession can kind of merge. And by the time we got to egg donation, we had been through 5 years of recurrent miscarriages, infertility treatments. You know, I'd injected myself with the urine of postmenopausal nuns. I'd chugged Robitussin. that's what they used to, the fertility drugs were synthesized from. You know, we had been through so much, and it had been 5 years. And I think, you know, I imagine that every listener out there either has been through some aspect of this miscarriage or infertility or knows somebody who has. And it's just, it's a devastating thing. You know, it is traumatic. It's like a line in the sand of your life. And it challenges, it stresses your marriage. It challenges everything that you believe about yourself and your world. And you're just shattered by it. And we had a friend who, a wonderful, generous, loving friend who was 21 years old, who had been saying, if you ever want to do this, I'd be willing to do it. And it had been 5 years. I was 40. We'd been talking about it, and we decided to give it a try.
Now, you had a friend who volunteered her egg, so you didn't have to go shopping for a donor. Tell us a little bit about how the procedure works.
Egg donation is really like an IVF cycle cut in half. So you have two different women. You first take birth control pills to sync your cycles, and I have to say, this is totally miraculous to me. I mean, at one point, I was talking, when I was for the Times piece, I was talking to this guy who was a pioneer in developing this stuff. And I said, can we just take like a step back here for a second and think about the fact that you can take an embryo made from one person's egg and put it into another woman and they will become pregnant? I mean, it's a really mind-boggling thing. And he sort of went, oh yeah, I guess it is. But the way that they do it, yeah, the way that they do it, scientists, is you sync your cycles with the birth control pill. Then the first person starts taking ovulation stimulating injections, like you would take for an IVF cycle, and those stimulate the ovaries to make multiple follicles containing multiple eggs. Meanwhile, the recipient person is taking estrogen to start preparing, which is an also injected, to start preparing her womb for implantation. And then when the donor's eggs are ripe, she's injected with something to make her ovulate. And before she can, they swoop in with a sort of minor surgery and suck the eggs out. And then the male partner comes in and they, you know, have a date with their hand, and then they put the eggs and the sperm together, and they form embryos. Then the recipient adds a progesterone shot, and a few days later, the embryos are transferred to her uterus. 10 days later, they take the test. They find out if they're pregnant. But the really cool part for me is that then, after the first trimester, at the end of the first trimester, when the placenta takes over, she stops taking the shots, and the pregnancy just goes along as normally and naturally as any other. She's just like a garden variety pregnant person. And that's the part that I think is so incredibly amazing.
What are the signs that pregnancy through donor eggs is becoming a much more common way of getting pregnant?
Well, it's statistical. I mean, one thing is that it's now 12% of all assisted reproductive technology procedures, which is a pretty high percent, and it has gone from, say, in 1992, there were 1,800 attempts, and in 2004, there were over 15,000 attempts. So that's a pretty big jump. And then in the meantime, you have a huge increase in the birth rate among women over 40. Among women in their early 40s, it's 62% raise since 1990, which is astronomical. And, you know, the birth rate for women in their 20s has actually dropped during that period. So not all those women obviously use donor egg or even IVF. You know, a certain percentage of them get pregnant naturally. But by the time women who do use IVF are 43 years old, about a third of them are using donor egg, and by the time they're 47, about 91% do, of those who are doing IVF.
So, Peggy, your friend, you know, made you this offer to use her egg. Did that work out?
That did not work for us. In the end, my husband's sperm and her eggs just, you know, wouldn't. They just lay there. I like to think that even his gametes couldn't be unfaithful to me. But improbably, and I'm always a little uncomfortable talking about this because we had a real fluke. We got pregnant about a month later, actually, and had a baby the old-fashioned way. And in my book, I was really, really careful about that because I didn't want that to be the exclamation point at the end of the sentence of the book. I didn't want to say, and then we had a baby and blah, 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 and that made it all okay. Because that would not be true, really, it would be a betrayal, I felt, of the experience of so many women who went through this. So I'm very delicate about that. But yes, we had a daughter who's now 4 years old.
My guest is Peggy Orenstein, and her article in the New York Times Magazine about donor eggs is called Your Gamete Myself. She's also the author of a memoir about going through infertility treatments for several years on the way to becoming a mother, and that memoir is called Waiting for Daisy. One of the parts of the process you have to go through if you're doing the donor egg approach is finding a donor. And what are some of the ways that people find donors?
Well, if you're using an unknown donor, that is, if you're not using a friend or family member, you go to agencies, and some of the agencies demand that you come in and look through their books, and others have it up on the web, and you either have a password or if you just go right now to your browser and punch in egg donation, you'll find it. And it's weird because I was sitting with one of my subjects, and we were looking and we were talking about this, and you find yourself as a woman looking at, and one of the interesting things is that egg donors, you have all these pictures. You get their pictures. You know, you see their caps and gowns of their high school graduation and them on family vacations and in their little princess gowns when they were preschoolers, or ballet outfits, all this stuff. If you were using a sperm donor, you wouldn't have any of that. So you get much more information and much more of a picture of the person. But when you're sitting there online and looking at these pictures of these young women, the only way I can really describe it is that it made me feel kind of like a guy looking at like online dating. You know, you start looking at them at their component parts and sort of objectifying them in a weird way. But you can get a fair amount of information from the profiles of the women.
Do you pay the egg donor directly or do you pay the agency? And does the agency or the donor charge more for certain traits, like for having a high IQ or, you know, a little nose or large breasts or, you know, whatever the thing is that the person's looking for?
You can either, you know, donors can actually advertise directly on the internet. So you can just make a deal. There's all of this. This whole industry is completely unlicensed and unregulated. So, Terry, if you wanted tomorrow to put up a website and say, I'm a donor agency and go get a bunch of young women, you could do that. Any of us could do that. So you either are going through, and you know, some are more reputable than others. You either go through an agency, and then the agency is paying the donor, and you're also paying agency fees and all this other stuff. Or you can, you know, go directly to some young woman who's advertising on the web or whatever, and people do it different ways. And the first thing you have to think about is that people generally who are doing this are experiencing a lot of loss. And the first thing that they generally think about is wanting the donor to look like them or be like them or feel like them in some way. And usually that involves looks and or intelligence. And health is another biggie. So that's where they start. And then I think it's a process of letting go of that idea of, you know, first you have to lose the idea that you're going to be using your own egg. Then you have to lose the idea that you can find a perfect replacement for that. And it's a kind of series of little losses within the big loss before you get to the place where you're willing to embrace this. And along the way, yeah, they're not supposed to be charging more for personal attributes such as ethnicity, Asian donors, Jewish donors. I think French-Canadian donors get more. And they're not supposed to be charging more for blondes or for, you know, Ivy League graduates, high IQs, all that. But typically, yeah, they do.
My guest is Peggy Orenstein, and she has a piece in Sunday's New York Times Magazine about donor eggs, and the piece is called Your Gamete, Myself. She's also written a memoir about her experiences over the course of about 5 years using infertility treatments to try to get pregnant, and she finally got pregnant with her husband the old-fashioned way. And her memoir is called Waiting for Daisy. Well, I think one of the big issues for parents who go the egg donor route is who do you tell and when do you tell them? Do you think, Peggy, that there's a stigma to getting pregnant through a donated egg and that there's a reluctance to tell people because of that?
Yeah. I mean, there's still a lot of misunderstanding about what it means to do donor egg, what even the process is or what you're doing exactly. And people are afraid. They're afraid their families won't accept the child. They're afraid their communities won't. I mean, it depends on many things. It depends on where you live. It depends on your family, your community, your ethnic group. You know, there's a lot of reasons people may or may not choose to tell. And typically, in the beginning, couples were discouraged from telling anybody, including the child, because they were counseled that it would just be confusing. As time has gone on, that trend has shifted and some would argue actually reversed, and that now more people either are or are planning to tell their children. But it's complex. You know, when do you tell? How do you tell? Do you tell strangers on the street? Do you tell your immediate family? Do you tell your aunt in Detroit? You know, who it's hard, and I often wondered, part of what led me to write this piece was, since I had tried this and it hadn't worked, I'd gone a certain amount of the way into thinking about what all that would be like, but I never really knew. You know, what would it be like to see my husband's face in my child but not mine, or what would it be like to, if somebody on the street said, oh, your baby looks just like you, you know, if you smile and nod, do you feel dishonest? You know, what all these questions of whether, you know, what the asymmetry would be like between my husband and me, all those things, I really wanted to explore what that was like for people.
Are there legal issues about whether the woman who donates the egg has any claim to the baby, or whether the child has any legal right to know who the woman was who donated the egg?
Not so much in this country, no. You do a contract with the donor. There's a sort of standard legal contract, and I actually don't know in, you know, state to state how this works. I know in California that it's pretty clear that the donor has no claim, and that the child right now does not have the right to seek out the donor unless the donor has consented.
You say in Britain that they recently banned anonymous donation. What's the situation there?
Britain banned anonymous donation, which means that if the child knows, now, what they did not mandate disclosure, so you don't have to tell your kid. So if you don't tell your kid may never find out. But if your child knows, when that child is 18, and this is a voluntary thing in the United States, some agencies and donors do this. But when the child in England is 18 or older at any time, they can have access to the personal information of the donor. In other words, they can track the donor down. And there's a registry, a national registry there of donors. And truly, since that's happened, their donor pool has shrunk by about 25%.
And why do you think that is?
I think donors are afraid. I think they're afraid that the child is going to come knocking someday and want money or want a relationship. And really, that's not something that happens. There has been identity release sperm donation for a long time, and the children who have done that are teenagers now, and a study of them has shown that most of them would like to meet their donor someday or have some interest in meeting their donor, but fewer than 7% would expect to have any kind of parent-child relationship with the person.
What do you think are the biggest questions now that surround the process of donor eggs for pregnancy?
I think there's questions about how we can conduct this in an ethical way that works for donors and recipients and make sure that everything is healthy and fair for them. I think there's a big question, which I actually didn't address in the Times piece, of what's going to happen with half-siblings and whether kids are going to want to seek them out and what that's all going to mean.
Now, in your memoir, you run through, as you did a little earlier in the interview, some of the things you did to try to get pregnant. And you said that you had no idea how easy it would be to lose all sense of reason, to do things you swore you would never do to become a mother, and then even go beyond that. It sounds, the way you describe it, that once you get into the infertility process, that there's always another step to take, there's always another treatment to try, there's always a reason to be hopeful, and it can become really obsessive.
Yeah, it does. I call it the infertility vortex. It becomes it becomes obsessive, and that's why I say Clomid was my gateway drug, because it did feel like that. You know, it's like one minute you're popping a couple of pills and the next minute you're taking out a second mortgage on your house to do another round of IVF. And there's always that sense that if you just do it one more time, if you just try one more thing, that you can make it work. And it is so easy to get lost in that.
Although you went to extremes to conceive and tried every approach that you could, you say that 10 years earlier, you thought you didn't even want to be a mother. What changed you?
I think a couple of things changed for me. I mean, some of it was I was younger 10 years ago, and at the time when I was growing up, motherhood was not something we were as interested in. We were more interested in self-development. And then for me, I turned 35, and we thought, okay, it's time to do this. My husband's father died. That was a big change for us, and that made us feel that we weren't being part of the life cycle, and we decided that we were going to try to get pregnant. And then I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so that sort of threw my life off track and also gave me a kind of cosmic shake and made me think, oh my gosh, I really did want to have children, at least until I recovered. And then I mean, you know, the truth is that I was always ambivalent. As long as I'm not now, I'm not after I had a child, which is interesting. But the whole time I was going through all that I went through, I was ambivalent. I wasn't sure I really wanted to be doing this. And yet I felt this compulsion to keep moving forward with it.
Yeah, one of the treatments that you used to try to get pregnant was daily injections of fertility drugs. And I assume some of those drugs had like estrogen in it. And a lot of women who have breast cancer, which you did, are supposed to stay away from estrogen. So were you taking risks with your health by using those injections?
I don't think there have been any established links between infertility drugs and breast cancer. There have been some suggestions of associations with ovarian cancer in certain cases. And since I am also at risk of that, that was what I felt like I was risking. And the minute I popped that pill, and what I had read was that as long it was only a higher risk for women if you didn't end up having a baby ever. So I thought, okay, well, this will work as long – this is okay to do, but now I really have to have a baby. Once I do this, I can't go back. I have to keep going until I have a baby or I've risked my health.
You had several miscarriages. You had one miscarriage when you were in Japan. You were writing a piece there on Japan's falling fertility rate. Your husband was doing a documentary on Hiroshima survivors. So you had a miscarriage when you were in Japan. And you write that it's very interesting in Japan that there's actually rituals for miscarriages there. And there's even a word for babies that are miscarried. So tell us about the word and about the rituals.
it was a good experience is the wrong word, but it was an interesting experience to be in a culture that actually acknowledged miscarriage. And what they have is a ritual. They call a miscarried or aborted fetus, which we obviously don't have a word for, a mizuko, which means water child. And the idea is that you flow into life gradually and you don't actually fully solidify as a person until you're, I think, 7. And then you start flowing back out of life again when you're about 60. And a mizuko so is coming into life but is not life. And then when you miscarry or abort, it goes back to the primordial waters and is guided back by a bodhisattva, an enlightened being called Jizo. And Jizo looks after the mizuko and guides it into its next life. And, you know, in Western culture, in I'm Jewish, in Judaism or in Christianity, there is nothing traditional acknowledging miscarriage. And it was cathartic to be able to have something to do. And I heard about this. I'd seen there's these Jizo statues all over Japan. They're these little sort of, they look sort of like monks and sort of like babies. They're little stone statues that you see in temple yards. And they have little red crocheted bonnets or maybe flowers in front of them that people have put there. And so I went off in search of a place to make an offering to Jizo, and that's one of the chapters in Waiting for Daisy. But it was also part of what inspired me to write the book, because originally I wrote that piece in a different form for the New York Times Magazine, and it took me a long time to be ready to publish it. But when I did, I don't think I've gotten so much mail on anything else I have ever written in my life, or it's mail for such a long time. I still get mail from people who say they carry the piece around, women and men too, because they felt that somebody that they had never been able to talk about this loss, and they had been expected to just, you know, move on and don't worry about it. You'll get pregnant again and all of that. And it is a really painful loss of a potential child. And then the other complicating factor for me in doing all that is that I'm pro-choice and adamantly so. And it was very hard, I think, and it is hard for a contemporary woman to figure out how the pro-choice politics jibe with the fact that you feel that you've lost something that you're not supposed to feel as a life.
So in reconciling how the incredible loss you felt, you know, at losing your baby at 3 months, and also at the same time being very pro-choice and thinking that, you know, abortion is okay and you're not killing a fully formed human being, how did you reconcile the two, and what even language did you use? I mean, because when you talk about abortion, you talk about a fetus, but when you talk about a miscarriage, you talk about losing your baby. Can you talk a little bit about how you work that out in your mind and even what language you use to think about it?
Well, I think that I lost the dream of a child that I imagined that I would have when I found out that I was pregnant. And it was really helpful for me to do this ritual in Japan. So in Japan, for either a miscarriage or an abortion, you can make this offering and wish your, you know, I got to wish my miscarried, my mizuko, well in its next life. And whether that was with me or, you know, the mizuko can come back to you or it can go to somebody else, but it's going to go somewhere because it's Buddhist. So I wished it well in its next life. And even if it was with somebody else, that felt like a comfort to me.
What effect did trying to get pregnant for 6 years and going through all the infertility treatments, spending all the money on the treatments, often having sex time to the fertility calendar, what kind of pressures did that put on your marriage?
More than anything, Waiting for Daisy is about a marriage and the story of a marriage. And through the whole thing, my husband, Stephen, was saying to me, I want a baby, but I want a relationship more. And I was saying back to him, yeah, me too, but let's try to have a baby, you know. And I think at the apotheosis of the awfulness of it, we were in Santa Cruz, and we were he was doing filming down there, and we were staying at this hotel, and he said really lovingly to me that he just couldn't do this anymore, and that he was feeling like I was so obsessed and so angry and so bitter. This was, you know, a good 5 years in. That he felt if somebody came along and paid attention to him and wanted to be with him and could see him, that he was vulnerable, to having an affair. And he wanted me to know that because he didn't want me to ever be able to say, I don't know how this happened. And he wasn't saying he was going to do it. He was just telling me how he was feeling. And honest to God, and this is my moment of shame on national radio, my response was, now how do I get him to have sex with me because I'm ovulating? And I think, you know, it was that I felt, and this is part, you know, part of the real important point of Waiting for Daisy for me was that I felt all along that, you know, the relationship, I knew our relationship was strong. I knew it could weather a lot and come back. And I thought if I – it was okay to push it aside while I went through this because it was necessary to do that. And I never expected that it was going to go on for 6 years either. You know, I didn't expect it would end up being a book. I expected it – every month I thought it would be over. And then we could get back to the business of being the couple that we had once been. And we have – you know, I don't know what would have happened if we hadn't had this improbable good luck of conceiving our daughter. Yeah. I don't know, and we were going through, we also were going through international adoption and various things, but I don't know what would have happened to us, but we have been, you know, we have been able to get back to being a loving couple again, but the cracks remain, and I don't want to forget what can happen in a marriage or what can happen to a person when you get out of control.
You eventually, after trying absolutely everything, you eventually got pregnant, and I know this is a ridiculous question, but how do you think it happened that finally you were able to just conceive? Like what? I know that's an unanswerable question, but
I think it's just random, Terry. Obviously, yeah. You know, I mean, people are always trying to put something on it, like, oh, you must have relaxed, or you know, we through our contacts in Hiroshima, we were offered a baby for adoption in Japan, and Japan doesn't really do adoption. But we did have this we were told this girl was pregnant, and a couple days later we were called and were told the baby was born. And so we were thinking, oh, okay, we'll do this. And we were trying to do international adoption in the space of 3 weeks, which if you know anything about it, it's really not possible. And all these, you know, it was very difficult. And a couple weeks later I realized that I was pregnant, and I told Stephen, and he said, well, you know, that doesn't really mean much. You've been pregnant before. And so we continued to move forward, not knowing if we were going to have one baby, two babies, or no babies. And that was the most crazy time of all of it. But because of that, people will often say, well, maybe it was because you were, you know, trying to adopt, or all this stuff that's just myth. And I think the bottom line truth was we got lucky. And I had gotten pregnant before, so it was possible for me to get pregnant. And I just that month happened to have a good egg, and that's it.
So you finally got pregnant, and you became a mother. And how old were you when you became a mother?
I was almost 42.
Mm-hmm. What have been some of the biggest surprises of actually being a mother after having tried for so many years?
Well, I think there's really two surprises. I'm going to try to say this without sounding at all trite. I really didn't expect to love it as much as I do. I had been so ambivalent for so long that I worked all my ambivalence out in advance. And I think, you know, our bodies are not – it's not great for your – you know, being almost 42 is not the best time to try to have a child. But psychologically and personally, it was a fabulous time for me to have a child. I was really ready. I was open to it. My work and everything was in a great place to be able to do it. It's a wonderful time. And I think the other surprise was the absolute vulnerability that you feel as a parent. And I just was not at all prepared for this feeling that my heart is walking around on the outside of my body now. And if anything happens to my heart, it's going to kill me.
Since your husband is of Japanese descent, your daughter looks Asian, and people assume that you adopted her, which is pretty
yes,
funny
well,
considering all the
I know.
extremes
I know.
You went to, and then you finally actually got pregnant. But how awkward is that for you when people say to you things like, where did you get her?
Well, I think, first of all, I have to say I look like Casper the Friendly Ghost's fraternal twin. So it's, you know, there's a big difference here, and not all babies. Hapa is what we call a biracial Asian kid in our community, and not all Hapa kids look like the Asian parent. I have a lot of Asian mom friends who with HAPA kids who get confused for the nanny, which is equally irritating. But I am frequently, or more when Daisy was little, because now she's a cognizant human being and people are a little less rude, but they people would come, you know, across an airport or across a restaurant up to me and say, "Oh, what a beautiful baby. Where did you get her?" That was kind of the classic line. Or, "Oh, what a beautiful baby. Is she from China or Korea?" And I began to say, and, you know, there's nothing, adoption is a great thing, but it happens she's not adopted, and that people can't seem to see that, you know, that people come in different combinations. And I just have a stack answer, which is if you said, "Where did you get her?" I'd say, "From my uterus." Or, "Is she from China or Korea?" "She's from my uterus." But I'll tell you that when I went to do this egg donor piece for the Times, and a big chunk of it is about the impact of resemblance talk on egg donor recipient parents and the ways that it can feel undermining or delegitimizing, and that it can cause both those who disclose to their kids and those who don't to question those decisions. I really understood that. I had a conversation with my editor where she was sort of saying, "Well, I don't really quite get why that's such a big deal." And I said, "No, I understand it, because people are always coming up to me and sort of insinuating that I'm not the real parent of my child. And whether she were adopted or weren't adopted, I am the real parent of the child." And it does get irritating and upsetting. And I did find myself, not so much anymore, but sometimes when I was alone with my daughter, noticing what I call the look, where people – and people, of course, will look. You know, we look really different. We're clearly racially different. And they look back and forth, and I see it, and I feel a little tense. And I would feel more relaxed when the three of us were out together, because then it was clear what was going on. It was clear that she was a biracial kid. My husband was Japanese-American, and I was Caucasian. But it's – you know, I am certainly aware of it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Peggy Orenstein wrote Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover story on donor eggs. Her memoir about her 6 years of infertility treatments is called Waiting for Daisy.